Dear Jesus, may I enter into the eternal divine order of God to place my absolute nothingness in the heart of the Most Holy Trinity, to give to my God the joy of fulfilling the purpose of my existence by doing all the acts of my life through the Immaculate Heart of my Mother Mary and in the divine will of God. And in this same manner may I live, pray, act, eat, walk, sleep, and do everything. May my soul be devoid of any other longings, wants, or desires, and may you, my beloved divine will, do with me whatever you want or desire. All I ask is that you bind me to your most holy will so intimately that I may never swerve from carrying out what I know to be your good pleasure, and that I remain so docile to the movements of your divine will that you never perceive even a breath of resistance in my soul to your requests of me. Come, divine will, with all the angels and saints, especially my sweet Mother Mary, to touch my forehead, to imprint on it the Holy Spirit, and infuse in me true light, so that I may understand the truths and the good that are in these writings and prayers. Amen. We start this evening with November the 6th, 1926, and we're starting with a wonderful message about the new divine will apostles that Jesus wants to raise up. So Louisa begins by saying that she was feeling all oppressed under the weight of the privation of her sweet Jesus. Oh, how I longed for the celestial fatherland, she said, in which I will no longer lose sight of him. I will no longer be subjected to the hard martyrdom of feeling myself dying without dying. Louisa was very extraordinary in so far as she couldn't wait to die and go to heaven. Most human beings are afraid to die because they're not so sure of their destiny on the other side. Louisa was very sure. Now, she said, while I was tired and exhausted of waiting, my sweet life, my dear good, my sweet Jesus moved in my interior. But he was all afflicted, and it seemed that he was sending chastisements over the earth. Now, the next bit, I think, is very, very lovely. But in order not to give me more pain, he didn't want me to see them. He knows that she goes wild when she sees the chastisements. But from the way I saw him, she said, I understood the chastisements. Louisa is looking at Jesus long enough to know every single expression, every movement. And so she gets the message anyway. It's just that she doesn't see the disasters that are actually happening on the ground. And sighing, Jesus told her, my daughter, courage, let me finish manifesting to you what is necessary regarding the kingdom of my will, so that nothing will be lacking in order for the kingdom of the divine will in the midst of the human family to actually be established. And then after that, he said, when everything is complete, I'll quickly take you to the fatherland. In other words, I can't take you until the job is done. You're the one that we have chosen to work with to establish the kingdom of the divine will, and you have to hang around until the job is complete. Louisa realizes she has to stay around for a little while longer. Unfortunately, this is only volume 20. If she knew that there were 16 more volumes to go, I think she mightn't have had a good day. It's just as well that we're not told too far in advance of what's coming. So Jesus said to her, do you think you're going to see the full triumph of the kingdom of the supreme fiat before coming to heaven? It is from heaven, he said, that you will see its full triumph. The same thing will happen to you as happened to me in redemption, he said. I did everything that was needed. I formed the foundation. I gave the laws and the counsels that were needed. I instituted the sacraments. I left the gospel as the norm of their life. I suffered unheard of pains unto death. But while being on earth, I saw little or almost nothing of the fruits. A tree takes time to mature. And he himself said that the kingdom of heaven was like a mustard seed that was planted in the unfertile, hostile environment of the Roman Empire. So he said, while I was alive, he's merely trying to console Louisa as to why she's not seeing great things happening. After I had done everything and there was nothing left to do, I entrusted everything to the apostles. Now, watch what's going to happen about this entrusting the divine will. Okay, I left everything to the apostles, he said, that they might be the town criers, we would say, or the heralds of the kingdom of redemption, so that the fruits of the works that I did in redemption could come out. So he's now introduced the topic, and in the next paragraph we have the new apostles of the divine will. The same thing is going to happen in the kingdom of the divine will. He said, we'll do it together. Louisa can't do it on her own. John 15:5, without me, you can do nothing. So we will do it together. And my daughter, he said, your pains, your long sacrifices, your incessant prayers that my kingdom will come soon, and my manifestations about it, he said, I will unite everything together with me and will form the foundation. So Jesus is doing all the work, even though it looks like Louisa is doing it. And once I have completed everything, he said, I will entrust the kingdom to my ministers. They're the priests of the church. So that, like second apostles of the kingdom of my will, they will be the heralds or the town criers of the kingdom of the divine will. Do you think that the coming of Father de Francia, who showed so much interest and who has taken to heart the publication of What Regards My Will, came by chance? No, no, he said, I had to dispose them. In other words, we could do nothing. Without me, Jesus said, you can do nothing. Jesus says that he chose Hannibal de Francia for this, and he was an extraordinary confessor to Louisa for a time. He was the one who gave the imprimatur to the first 10 volumes, and by the time he died, I think 19 volumes had been accepted. But the imprimatur was only on the first 10 by the time Hannibal de Francia died, I think. So, do you think the coming of Father de Francia was by chance? He said, no, I myself disposed it. It's a providential act of the supreme will. Now, notice providential. The church has long since trained its members to divine providence, that there's nothing by chance in our lives. Everything is by divine providence. No matter what happens, divine providence has permitted it or directly actually wants it. It is a providential act of the supreme will, who wants him as the first apostle of the divine fiat. So Hannibal de Francia, priest, is the first priest apostle and proclaimer of the divine will. Now, why would Hannibal de Francia be chosen? It's because he has all the right contacts. And since he happens to be the founder of an order, it's easier for him to approach bishops, priests and people, and also within his own institute, in order to proclaim the kingdom of my will. That's why I assist him so much, and I give him special light, because in order to understand my will, it takes great graces. Would you please underline that if you're dealing with your own book at this moment? In order to understand the divine will, it takes great graces, not little lights. We don't get this by our natural intelligence. It takes the sun, that means the source of light, that's himself, to understand a divine, holy and eternal will. That's the first thing. Only God can enable us to understand the divine will. And it takes a great disposition on the part of the one to whom this office is entrusted. Now, since we're not priests and the priest leaders haven't taken over yet, then I sort of put us lay people in the position of John the Baptist announcing that the time has come and pointing out to the church what the Lord wants to do. But even among us, it takes the Lord's own personal intervention to enable us to actually understand this text. We need great graces. We also need the proper dispositions in order to do it. Okay. And then he said, reminding Louisa of what she complained about for at least 10 volumes, the daily coming of the priest, I myself also disposed. She kept asking him to stop the priest from coming, and he kept refusing, and she kept up asking him. It was really extraordinary. He said, I myself disposed it, that I might find quickly the first apostles of the kingdom of the divine fiat. You see, if he didn't insist on priests actually assisting Louisa, the church would not have known that this was a very important revelation. The church would not have known that it had to get involved. The church would have done what it has done with other revelations which lay people have received. They would have shoved it aside and forgotten about it maybe for centuries. We know that the revelations of Sister Faustina were simply shoved into a drawer in the Vatican and they forgot all about them. And it was the extremely important introduction to the kingdom of the divine will that we would go through divine mercy. And it took somebody to be elected pope to have the authority to take them out of those drawers and get them out into the people, as happened with John Paul II. So Jesus said that the priest who came to attend her every day was part of his insistence that the church would get involved from the beginning. He said, therefore, let me finish first, so that after I've completed, I may entrust it to the new apostles of my will, and you will be able to come to heaven, and it's from up there that you'll see the fruits of the kingdom, as he has already told her in the first paragraph. In the final paragraph of this message, then, it is in the divine will we live in the unity of our Creator. So Louisa said, I continue to do my usual acts in the supreme volition, and I thought to myself, my poor mind goes round through the sea, the sun, and the heavens. Now notice when she does rounds, I pointed this out to you before, she stays with some things, the sea, the sun, the heavens. She doesn't go through interminable lists like I have seen some people pass around, because it involves the contemplation of the divine will in the sea, in the sun, in the heavens. So she said, I went everywhere in order to follow the acts of the adorable will, what he does in creation. But once I finish going around, I always find myself down below in my hard exile. Now, the little reflection she's going to make now, I think is really, it's funny. She said, no matter how much my soul soars into the heavens and does these wonderful contemplations, I'm back in my hard exile when I'm finished. Oh, how I would like to remain at least in the blue heavens, which she usually calls the Asia. We call that space, or the place for the planets. To do the office of a star for my Creator, she'd like to join the stars. You can see what a child mind she has. But I would disappear in the midst of the stars, because I'm neither beautiful nor shining like the stars. And so they'd put me out, hurling me down to the bottom. My long exile, she said, even the stars would get rid of me. But while I was thinking of this, my sweet Jesus moved in my interior and he told me, my daughter, one who lives in my will lives in the unity, because the Creator is a unity of three persons, lives in the unity of her Creator, who keeps with himself in his unity the whole of creation. The whole of creation is in the divine will, because if it goes out of the divine will, it simply disappears. And just as he keeps the creation, so does he keep in this unity the soul who lives in the eternal fiat. So not only is the whole of creation there kept in the unity of the divine will, but also the souls who are living in the eternal fiat. And this unity brings her all the reflections of her Creator. Now, in the next couple of messages, we're going to be hearing reflections, reflections, reflections. It's not the most wonderful translation you could use, because you're going to hear that the word reflection that's given to us here means the image of her Creator. And it also means the echo of her Creator. I don't think that's a wonderful translation. So in this unity brings her all the image and echo of her Creator, as well as his unity with all creation, in such a way that the living image of the one who created her can be seen in her soul. That's the bit you colour if you have your own book. So these reflections of the Creator, he's going to tell us that every act we do, more and more of that image is imparted to us, until if we reach the completion of what he wants in our lives, the whole of the divinity will actually be manifested in our souls, which is almost beyond belief in its incredibility. Absolutely massive. But if you go to 2 Corinthians 3:18, you'll find St. Paul saying that as we contemplate God and he contemplates us, we become like what we contemplate. And this is what is spoken about here, that the more we contemplate God, the more God-like we become. We become like him. And he says that in the divine will, as a result of our contemplation of him and living in the divine will, we become the echo or the living image. Now, that living image is also what you call a living host, that our whole person simply becomes the temple of the living God, 1 Corinthians 3:16, 1 Corinthians 6:16. Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and the Spirit of God dwells in you? Okay. We become the echo of everything that God is proclaiming to others. It's really, really fantastic. So, in such a way, the living image, now notice it's not a picture. It's a living presence, just as you have in the sacred host, the living presence of Jesus. The living image of the one who created her can be seen in the soul. People can actually detect the presence, the active presence of God in us. And by maintaining his unity with all, he keeps her in the reflections of all the things created by him. You see, the word reflections is going to keep repeated, but now that you know what it means, I won't keep correcting it. And these reflections form the sea, the sun, the heavens, the stars, and all the enchanting varieties of nature in the depths of her soul. Now, he started off by saying that all of creation is in him. We are in him. When we live in the divine will, then the reflection of him and all of creation is in us. So what he wants to find in us, when he looks in us, is that he will see the whole of his creation reflected in us. And the messages are going to be talking about that there will be a sun and a sea and a flowery earth and everything absolutely inside of us. In other words, there will be an interior creation, but it is a living creation, a creation that can actually respond verbally to God and therefore speak on behalf of all of the mute creation outside of us. So the external creation is reflected perfectly internally. When I was very young, I didn't think I was young at the time, but I was. I remember hearing a most wonderful lecture from a professor of biology in Dublin University, where I was studying science. And because some of the students in my class had given up going to mass after a couple of months of science, I asked this professor to speak to us. And he gave the most incredible talk. I'm just so sorry we had no way that we could actually record it. And he began by saying that the structure that is in the cell of your little finger, any of your fingers, any part of your body, but he just took the finger as an example. He said, is the same as the structure of the universe outside. And so he said, what you see in magnitude in the universe outside, you see in miniature in your own cell. So it's not for the first time that God is trying to say to us that his creation has got to be mirrored inside of us. That the divine will in creation is in us and the divine will in heaven is in us. It brings it all into an absolute extraordinary unity. So we become more and more like the one who made us. Okay. So he keeps her, that is the soul, in the reflections of the things created by him, and these reflections form the sea, the sun, the heavens, the stars, and everything in the depths of her soul. That's the bit we're emphasizing right now. The soul who lives in my will, placed in the azure heavens, would be the most beautiful ornament in this azure vault. So he's trying to tell Louisa she has the message backwards if she thinks that she would be ugly by comparison with the beauty of the stars. He said it's the opposite. Such as to astonish the heavens and the earth. She would have all within herself. Now watch this. What they would see was actually within herself, she would hold her creator. This is the astonishing prodigy that people are going to see when somebody in the divine will actually passes over from this earth to heaven, that they take their creator with them. Because she has in her soul her own creator. And there she has a heaven, a sun and a sea, everything, but she has them as her own. Nor would she lack even the earth, all flowery and the sweet singing of the birds, bearer of the joy and of the harmonious music of our creator, because each created thing contains a divine note. Now notice the harmony and beauty of the whole of creation. And everything fits in with everything else. Beauty is actually harmony and order. And when we listen to music that is extraordinarily harmonious, it also brings a sense of peace and joy to us as well. Therefore, instead of hurling you down, he said, they would aspire to keep you in their midst because among the many prodigies that my will contains, it has the power to portray all of our works in the soul. So when the mission of the divine will is completed in us, if we live long enough and are generous enough and persevering enough to actually let it happen, then all of the divine works will actually be manifest in your soul. We like to centralize all of the divine will acts in her. And the divine will is not content unless it sees its own beauty in the soul. If it doesn't find its echo, its joy, and all of itself, it won't be happy. Okay. So I want to give you Psalm 96, verse 9. Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness, which is living in the divine will. So let's come to November the 10th, 1926. And here we have that one who actually lives in the divine will encloses all of creation within herself. So we're following on from the last message, okay? And she is therefore the reflector of her creator. So you can see in that soul the presence and the work of the creator. Louisa says, my days always alternate between the privations and the short visits of my sweet Jesus. And many times he comes like a flash and he escapes. And as he escapes, I remain with the piercing nail. When will he come back? And sighing, I call him my Jesus come. Now, we haven't had this for quite a long time. Louisa used to lament like this in the volumes leading up to volume 20. But since we went into volume 20, she seems to have shifted from that. And I hear she is going back to it again. She's lamenting his absence. And she cries out to him to come back to her as the little exiled one. And in case you have forgotten or you've only joined me recently, I want to give you Psalm 63 and Psalm 42. Psalm 63 says that my soul longs for the Lord like a dry, weary land without water. Psalm 42 says that my soul is just drying up without the Lord. I'd like to give you also 2 Corinthians 5 verses 1 to 10, where St. Paul wanted to go to God and leave the earth behind. Then he realized he still had more work to do. And Joe, so for the sake of his neighbor, he said he would stay alive. So she asks the Lord to come back and bring me to heaven and don't leave me in my exile any longer. I can't bear it. But as much as I called him, my calls were in vain. So what did she do? You see, someone lesser than Louisa might fall into the problem of complaining or sinking into disappointment or some other negative or semi-negative reaction, which would actually set you back. Instead of that, what she did was she plunged herself into the divine will and abandoned herself completely. That is the solution. That's the solution to everything for us. And not only that, but she said, I did my usual acts. In other words, I didn't allow what I was feeling or the sense of need that I had to hold me back from the office that I was given. So I did my usual acts as much as I could, going around through the whole of creation. And my sweet Jesus, moved to compassion for my poor soul, which could bear no more, put out an arm from within my interior, all pity, he said to me. Putting out an arm from my interior, I wouldn't like to think about, but however, he was indicating that he was there, he hadn't gone anywhere. He told me, my daughter, courage, do not stop. Let your flight in my eternal will be continuous. Now she's going to come back in the next message and ask him what would happen if she did in fact stop even for a minute or a day, and he will explain that to her, but not here. You must know that my will does its continuous office in all created things, and its act is distinct in each thing. So what he's saying here is the divine will is in everything. If it exists at all, the divine will is there in it. The reason why it can continue to exist is that the divine will works continuously to preserve and to enable whatever the creature is to do what it was intended to do by its creator. So the divine will is operating all the time, continuously in us. I wouldn't be able to talk to you unless the divine will permitted that this creature could talk, and has got to enable that all the time. He says that even though there's only one divine will, and he's been telling us for many volumes, he only has one act. There are many, many different effects, he said. Its one act is distinct in each created thing. It does not do in the heavens, that's what we call space, the place for the galaxies, what it does in the sun, nor does it do in the sea what it does in the sun. It does different things, because if it did the same thing, the sun and the sea would be the same. And everything in the azure heavens would be the same if it was the same act. He says, no, 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 completely different effects in everything and in us as well. I mean, for you and I to actually function at this moment, the divine will has got to do many prodigies inside of us, because all of our organs, in my opinion, are miracles. My will, he said, has its special act in each thing. And even though I only have one will, its acts are innumerable. Now, the soul who lives in the divine will comes to enclose within herself all the acts that my will does in all of creation, just by the very fact of living in the divine will. So she must do what the divine will does in the heavens, the sun, the sea, and everything else. She must enclose everything within herself so that the soul may follow all the acts of my will. And not only this, but so that my will may receive the requiting act of the creature. That means the response, the correct response of the creature. So this is our response of, I love you, I adore you, I praise you, I bless you, I thank you, and so on and so forth. This is why we actually touch on the various things. Therefore, he said, if your act is not continuous, my will won't wait for you. You need to know that. We have it from all the generations gone before us that the times and the seasons await no man. Time continues. The seasons roll on. You might like to hang on to summer or autumn, but you cannot. You cannot. And he says you cannot get the divine will to wait for you either, because the consequences would be absolutely dire if he did. The divine will follow its course, and it leaves in you the void of its acts. This is why she's going to ask, how dangerous is it? It leaves in you the void of its acts and a certain distance and dissimilarity remains between you and my will. Now, what he's saying here is, if we refuse to do our acts, if we refuse to give the response to the divine will that we actually should, that we actually create a void which creates dissimilarity between him and us. And the whole idea is to bring us back into the full image that God intended. When he said in Genesis 1, 26 to 27, we will make man in our image, that we would actually be like God. But it has to be in a wholesome way, not with all kinds of holes in the picture. So in the next paragraph, we have to talk about returning to this full, complete image of our Creator and the making of this interior universe inside of us. This is how we become the echo or the image. Now, you must know the great good that you enclose by enclosing is definitely not English. The great good in which you take on or you embrace by enclosing within yourself all that my will does in creation. Okay, so if we take on into ourselves, if we embrace it, make it our own, then we are enclosing within ourselves everything that the divine will does in creation. That's massive. So while you follow the divine will's acts, you receive the reflection that is the image or the echo of the heavens, and the heavens are formed and extended in you. So what you are contemplating outside of you is created within you. So you have the external universe that you're contemplating in your rounds, and you have the internal universe being created inside of you. You receive the reflection or image or echo of the sun. The sun is formed in you, and you receive the reflection of the sea, and the sea is formed in you. You receive the reflection of the wind, the flower, and all nature, in sum, everything. And oh, how the heavens that protect. Now watch this, the way it's put. The sun that illuminates, warms, and fecundates. The sea that inundates and forms its waves of love and mercy and grace and strength for the good of all. The wind that purifies and brings rain over the souls burnt by passions. The flower of the perpetual adoration of your Creator. Look at that. These all arise from the depths of the soul. And this is why they're called seas, seas of graces. The image of the creation outside gives an opportunity to talk about what God is actually creating inside of us. So while we're not praying for ourselves at all, because in the divine will you don't pray for yourself. If you pray for yourself, you're not really in the divine will. The divine will is all for God and all for others. It's completely love, absolutely giving to God the glory and everything that he deserves, and then reaching out to give eternal life to everybody else. So it's all about love. So if you're still praying for yourself, you have a problem. The perpetual adoration of the Creator goes on in the depths of your being. Goes on all night, goes on all day. So it's very important for us to be aware of this and to tune into it. And so if the tragedy ever comes to us that the churches are closed to us, don't forget that you have the presence within you and that you can close your eyes and enter into that temple of God and give God perpetual adoration. Nobody can stop it unless they kill you. And then if they kill you, you do it in heaven anyway. So I just love the flower of perpetual adoration to our Creator. These all arise from the depths of your soul. Now, living in the divine will is in the depths of your soul. It's not on the surface of your lips. It's not a case of saying nice prayers. It's not a case of accomplishing things outside of yourself. It's a completely interior response to God It is the most private mission you can have. And it means that as more and more and more and more of us join this mission, then the true spiritual church is born. And the adoration of the Creator is going on all the time. And all the praise and glory that should be given to God is given to God. Nobody outside of you can see anything. And in a way, I call this the Church of the Catacombs. It can't be seen. Can't be seen. So it's safe. Not even somebody living in your house can see it. It's completely safe. It's very wonderful. I just love that expression, the flower of perpetual adoration of your Creator arises in the depths of the soul. This is why 'tis the prodigy of prodigies, the living in my will is the true triumph of the supreme fiat. It's the church at its most spiritual, the church at its most grace-filled, the church at its most powerful. And they will not be able to destroy it. Because it's completely interior. It's in a different dimension to what human beings actually deal with. They only know how to deal with material things. And so the soul becomes the image or reflector of her Creator and of all his works. So therefore we return to Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 to 27. And also Romans 8, 28 to 30. When Paul explains that Jesus intended to make us full images of himself. Look at the word full, nothing missing. Only when the divine will places in the soul what it can and knows how to do, then does our will triumph completely. Only when we actually allow the divine will to do what it wants to do and what it can do, then is the glory given. The divine will wants to see in the soul not only the one who created her, but all of his works. The divine will is not content if she lacks even the slightest thing that belongs to it. Now notice he's looking for completeness. He's looking for fullness. He's looking for perfection, because that's what perfection is, completeness. The souls of the supreme fiat will be our works, not incomplete as in redemption, but complete. They will be the new prodigies never before seen or known either by the earth or by heaven. Why do you say or by heaven? It's because most of the saints in heaven, I know we have some divine will saints in heaven by now, but most of the saints in heaven belong to the era of redemption before the divine will was revealed. So seeing a new generation of the children of God coming back with all of this in their souls would be astonishing to the saints in heaven. What will not be the enchantment, the surprise of these very blessed people when they see the first daughter of the divine fiat enter the celestial fatherland? What will their contentment, their glory not be in seeing her carrying her Creator with her? That is the thing. You see, our Blessed Mother was the very first that went back to heaven in this condition. Louisa is the second, and others after her to a lesser extent. So here you have Romans 8:19, not only all heaven, but the whole of creation, everything goes into absolute festivity and joy. So she goes into heaven carrying her Creator with her, with all of his works, the heavens, the sun, the sea, and the flowery earth and all its varied beauties. They will recognize in her the complete work of the eternal will. Because the divine will alone can make such prodigies and such complete works. It's just such an immense privilege that we should not under any circumstances hold back. Now, In the next paragraph, we speak about our Blessed Mother. She is the very first one who went back to glory, carrying her Creator with her. And so Jesus tells us that the kingdom of the divine will can be called the kingdom of the Virgin as well. And the children of the divine will be called the children of the Virgin, and that we have to be copies of her. So Louisa said, "Then I continued my abandonment in the eternal fiat in order to receive its reflections, its image, its echo. And my sweet Jesus added, my daughter, my celestial mother was the first who occupied the first place in heaven." Now I want to give you Mark 10:40 for there. You remember the discussion among the apostles that John and his brother got their mother to ask Jesus, could they be first and second in the kingdom, on your right and on your left? They were the positions of greatest power and authority in a kingdom. And Jesus said, it was only for the people for whom it was appointed. And the people for whom it was appointed was our Blessed Mother and Louisa, the first to enter the kingdom of heaven, carrying her Creator, and the second one. I'm sure the apostles would have gone mad at the idea that it could have been two women. So my celestial mother was the first who occupied the first place in heaven as daughter of the supreme volition. And because she was the first, she has around her a place for all the children of the supreme fiat. So around the Queen of Heaven, there are many empty places can be seen, which can be occupied by no one else but her copies. Now, this is extremely important. We have been called into the divine will so that we will become copies of our mother. And since she was the first from the generation of my will, the kingdom of the fiat will also be called the kingdom of the Virgin. Oh, how the sovereignty of all creation will be recognized in these children of ours. Now, these are the ones he calls children. They're not stepchildren. They're not adopted children. They're the real children. And they're the ones who fit Romans 8:19, that the whole of creation is waiting for them. In fact, by virtue of my will, these children will enjoy indissoluble bonds with all created things, because we've just explained those bonds right now. They will be in continuous relations and communication with them. They will be the true children in whom the eternal Creator will feel honored, glorified to have them as children. I think that's an immense statement, that God would feel honored to have us as his children. So that gives us an even greater stimulus to try and reach the fullness of what we are called to do. The Eternal Father would feel honored and glorified to have them as children, because he will recognize in them his own divine will operating, which has reproduced his true images. Now, I'm going to read a little text for you. I can't hold back. I normally just give you the reference, but I can't give it to you this time. I think it's fantastic. It's 1 John 3:1-3. How great is the love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called the children of God. And that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is because it doesn't know him. Dear friends, now we are the children of God, but what we are to be in the future is not yet known. Now you see, even John, this great, fantastic mystic, whom I absolutely love, didn't know about what we're reading about, because he was in the first century. All we know, he said, is that when he appears, we shall be like him when we see him as he really is. We will be like him. We will be his true images. And everyone who has this hope should purify himself and become as pure as possible. In other words, we should make ourselves more and more worthy of such an incredible gift. So, after this, Louisa said, I was thinking to myself, before sinning, she's shifting to another topic now. She's going to talk about Adam. And she's going to wonder, did Adam really suffer from breaking with God? And she's going to make a comparison between herself hesitating. Before sinning, my first father, Adam, possessed all these bonds and relations and communications with all creation. Because by possessing the supreme will as a whole, it was as though natural for him to feel within himself all these communications whenever it operated. Now, in withdrawing from this will so holy, she asks, did he not feel the tearing he made from his creation, the snapping of all the communications of all the bonds broken from the divine will as though in one single breath? And then she refers to herself earlier in volume 20. If by just thinking of whether I must do an act or not, or by just hesitating, I feel that the heavens tremble, the sun withdraws, and all creation is shaken, and is in the act of leaving me alone, notice leaving me alone, so much so that I myself tremble together with them and frightened immediately, without hesitating, I do what I must do. How could he do that? Did he not feel this tearing so harrowing and cruel? Okay, so then Jesus responds to her and he says, Adam did feel this tearing and harrowing, but in spite of this, he fell into the maze of his own will. Now, this is how we understand deliberate sin. You know something is wrong. You know you shouldn't do it. You know the consequences won't be great. You still do it. Now, that's the human will at its worst. So in spite of this, he fell into the maze of his will, which gave him no further peace, either to him or his posterity. Now, if you look at Genesis chapter 3-6, I'll summarize the three chapters for you. 3, 4, 5, there's four chapters. Sin increased and multiplied and filled the earth and conquered it, and the earth had to be cleansed with the flood in chapter 6. It's incredible. The speed with which a sin destroyed the earth was just absolutely amazing. So neither he himself nor his posterity knows what peace is, as we only need to look around us to see. All creation withdrew from him. Why? Because all creation is in the divine will. All the animals were in the divine will. They moved away. And the strange thing is we call them wild animals. Maybe we should say wild man. All creation withdrew from him as though in one single breath. And happiness, peace, strength and sovereignty, everything withdrew. So Jesus is giving her the detail of this incredible tragedy. Adam remained alone with himself. Now, to be alone with God is a very wonderful thing, but alone with yourself is a different matter altogether. Poor Adam, how much it cost him to withdraw from my will. Just by feeling isolated, no longer surrounded by the cortege of the whole of creation, he felt such fright and terror. So the kingdom of fear begins. And we're living in a world that is being governed by fear right now. He became a fearful man. That means a man full of fear. And fear is Satan's greatest weapon to destroy us. Anyone suffering from fear should be told to throw themselves into the arms of their Creator and trust God beyond reason, and you'll get your peace back and your joy and your union with God and everything else. What happened to Adam was that he became afraid of everything, even of my very works, and with reason, because it is said, one who is not with me is against me. So that's Luke 11:23. Since he was no longer linked with them by justice, they put themselves against him. Now you'll read this in Genesis chapter 3, verses 17 to 19. And also you can go on to the next section, 20 to 24. because there Adam was told that the earth was no longer going to cooperate with him. It was not going to produce the crops that he wanted. It was going to produce brambles and thistles and so on. The woman was told that she was going to suffer incredibly, particularly in childbirth. They were really going to suffer. The earth was going to be against them. Now, we're living at a time when the earth is literally at war with us. There are terrible floods and disasters all over the world, and we have so many volcanoes blowing all at the same time, and there's earthquakes every single day. You'd wonder whether we would get the message or not, that the earth is actually rebelling against us. Okay, so Jesus said that the earth refused to cooperate with him, and it was a matter of justice. They were putting themselves against him. Poor Adam, there is much reason to have compassion for him. And one of the things that you would never, ever think of, you see, the marvelous thing about God, and when we come before him in judgment, is that he will consider all the mitigating factors. When you see a huge case going to trial, a good judge will look for all the mitigating factors so that they can show as much mercy to the condemned person as possible. Look at this, what Jesus says. Adam had no example of anybody else who had fallen. He didn't know what to do. And of the great evil that had occurred to him, so that he might be watchful in order not to fall. He had nobody to look to. He was the first. He had no idea of evil. This is a very important statement. Adam was actually innocent of what evil was and its consequences. Unfortunately, he learned the hard way. In fact, my daughter, the evil, the sin, the fall of somebody else has two effects. For one who is evil and wants to fall, it serves as an example and as a spur and as an incentive to fall into the abyss of evil. But for somebody who is good and doesn't want to fall, it serves as an antidote and a deterrent, as help and defense so that they won't fall. In fact, seeing the great evil and misfortune of somebody else serves as an example in order not to fall and not to follow that same path, so as not to find oneself in the same situation. So Jesus is saying that we have much more helps than Adam had. There was nobody else. He had no idea what to do next. So the evil of somebody else causes one to be watchful and to be on their guard. Mark chapter 14, verse 38, Jesus tells his apostles five times in two sentences to be on their guard on the night of Gethsemane, because all hell was going to be let loose in Jerusalem. Therefore, he said, the fall of Adam is for you a great help, a lesson and a call. While he had no lesson on evil, because up to that moment, there was no evil. Evil didn't exist. There's a reflection on Adam you mightn't actually have thought of before you read this text. And it shows to me the great mercy of God that he will look for the mitigating circumstances. Thank you for coming, and we'll share it with you again next week.